All right, so get ready. We're diving into some seriously heavy brain food today.
Oh, yeah.
Aristotle's Metaphysics, Book 5.
That's the one all about what? The nature of reality itself.
You got it. Existence, causes, categories, the really big questions.
Definitely the heavy stuff.
But don't worry, think of this deep dive as like your own personal cheat sheet to understanding Aristotle.
Decoding Aristotle. I like it.
You know, sometimes when I read him, I feel like I'm learning a whole new
I know
language.
what you mean. It's like he's stretching your mind in ways you never thought possible.
Exactly. So let's jump right in. We're starting with a word you'd think would be pretty simple. Beginning.
Beginning. Yeah, seems straightforward.
But Aristotle, being Aristotle, outlines six different ways we talk about beginnings.
Sex. Whoa. So he's basically saying, like, hold on, before we even start, we need to agree on what a beginning even is.
Exactly. It's about making sure we're all on the same page.
Avoiding any, tripping over our own assumptions before we even get started.
I like it. So what are some examples of these different types of beginnings?
Well, you have an obvious one, like the physical origin of something.
Okay, so like the keel of a ship being the beginning of its construction.
Yeah, something concrete like that, a starting point in time and space.
Yeah.
But then it gets trickier.
Right, because he also talks about like conceptual beginnings.
Exactly, things that aren't, physical starting points, but they're the start of our reasoning.
So like the hypotheses we use when we're trying to prove something, right?
That's one. They're kind of a beginning in a way.
And this is where it gets really interesting because Aristotle even throws in things like the will of a leader as a kind of beginning.
Oh, right. Like the thing that sets events in motion, the
Yes.
catalyst.
So suddenly beginnings can be material or immaterial.
And tangible or just conceptual. It really makes you think, you know?
Absolutely. And that's just one word. We're just getting started.
Just so much more to unpack.
Okay, let's grab another tool from our philosophical toolkit.
Cause. Oh, yeah, that one always makes my head spin a little bit.
Mine too. But Aristotle had this brilliant way of breaking it down.
Right. He had the four main types of causes, right?
You're on it. Material, formal, efficient, and final.
A framework to help us really understand how things come to be and why they exist, too.
Yeah, exactly. But I think we need a real-world example here, something to make these causes a little less abstract.
For sure. Okay. Let's imagine a chair, a nice wooden chair.
Okay, I can picture it.
So first we have the material cause, that's the wood itself.
A physical stuff it's made of.
Right. But the wood alone doesn't make it a chair. So you also need the formal cause.
Which is?
It's the chair's shape, its design, the thing that makes it a chair and not, a table or something.
Okay, so material cause is what it's made of, and formal cause is what it is.
Exactly. Now, how about the efficient cause?
That one's about who or what brought the chair into being.
Yeah, like the carpenter, the one who used their skills, and their tools to shape that wood into a chair.
The carpenter's the agent of change in this case.
Right, the one who actually makes it happen.
Okay, and last but definitely not least, we have the final cause.
Ah, yes, the final cause.
This one's all about purpose.
The why behind it all. Why was this chair even made in the first place?
Was it to provide comfortable seating? Or was it made to be like a beautiful piece of furniture?
Right. Maybe the carpenter wanted to sell it, or maybe it was a gift.
So by understanding these four causes, we can really start to grasp how anything comes into existence.
And what its purpose is in the world, too.
Powerful stuff. Okay, I'm going to test you. How about a tree? What would its four causes be?
A tree. Let me think. So the material cause would be the things it needs to grow.
Soil, water, sunlight, that kind of thing.
Right. Then the formal cause would be its inherent structure as a tree.
The blueprint that makes it, well, a tree and not a flower or a bush.
Exactly. And the efficient cause, that would be the seed, the thing it sprang from.
And the final cause? That's a tricky one.
Yeah. I mean, is it to provide oxygen? To offer shade? Or maybe to provide a habitat for animals?
There could be so many purposes. It's amazing how this framework helps us see the interconnectedness of everything.
I know, right? It's like a whole new way of seeing.
Okay, let's keep rolling. Up next, we're going to add nature to our Aristotelian toolkit.
Nature. Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Because for Aristotle, nature is all about change.
The inherent principle of motion and change within things, it's what drives an acorn to become an oak tree.
Or a caterpillar to become a butterfly.
Or even a human to grow from a baby into an adult.
Like each thing has an inner compass, you know?
Yeah.
guiding its development.
It's what makes a thing that thing and not something else. It's essential.
So nature is about change, but it's also about identity. It's like he's saying change is built into what things are.
Yeah, it's not just something that happens to things. It's a fundamental part of them.
This is blowing my mind. And speaking of blowing my mind, how about we tackle the duality of one and many?
Oh, that's a good one. Because sometimes things seem separate. And then other times they feel like they're like part of a bigger whole.
So how do we figure out when things are considered one?
Well, Aristotle gives us some criteria. For example, you can have oneness through continuity, like a line.
Okay, so everything connected in that line is considered one.
Right. Or oneness through shared substance, like all water is one in a way.
And then there's oneness through a single definition, right? Like we can define all humans as rational animals.
Exactly. So even though we're all individuals, we're one group in that sense.
And that focus on definition is key because it leads us to another big concept, substance.
Substance, the underlying reality, what really exists.
It's the whatness of a thing, what makes it that thing.
And this is where Aristotle makes that crucial distinction between substance and accident.
Accidents, what are those?
So substance is the core, right? The unchanging essence. Accidents are the features that can, you know, come and go without changing that core.
Okay, I need an example. What would that look like?
Okay, how about a bronze statue? The bronze itself, that's the substance. But if it gets like a green patina over time from being outside.
That green color is an accident.
Exactly. It doesn't change the fact that it's still a bronze statue, still made of the same stuff.
So substance is unchanging. And accidents are superficial in a way. They come and go.
You got it. And this is super important for understanding change because it means a thing's identity can stay the same even when it goes through changes.
Okay, so like a person changes their hairstyle.
Right. They're still the same person underneath. Just with different hair.
This is making me think about how, like, we're not really static beings, right? We're always changing and growing.
Which leads us to another pair of concepts from Aristotle, potency and actuality.
Oh, yeah. Those are key for understanding change, right? Making sure it doesn't seem totally random.
Right. So potency is the potential to become something else, like that acorn we talked about.
It has the potential to be an oak tree, but it's not there yet.
Right. That's just its potency, the possibility. But then when it grows and develops,
it becomes an oak tree in actuality. It reaches its full potential.
It's like a seed becoming a plant or like a student studying hard and then boom, becoming a doctor.
Or even like us right now, working towards our full potential.
Exactly. It's a process of unfolding, of moving from what could be to what is.
Potency and actuality.
Wow.
It's so simple, but so profound at the same time.
Yeah. And Aristotle, he doesn't stop there. Next up, he throws us into the world of quantity.
Quantity, huh? Lots of numbers coming our way.
That's where quantum comes in. And it's not all just numbers. It's about how we measure and think about things.
So he's talking about, like, things we can count, right? The number of sheep in a flock.
That's one type, what he calls plurality. But he also talks about things that are measurable, like magnitude.
A magnitude.
Yeah, think of the length of a racetrack or, I don't know, the height of a mountain.
Okay, so it's about how we measure and compare things in the world.
Exactly. It's really laying the foundation for, like, math and physics.
Wow. I'm already feeling like my brain is stretching in new ways. We've got beginnings, causes, nature, substance, and now quantity.
It's like Aristotle's building a whole philosophical universe for us to explore.
And this is just the beginning.
There's still so much more to come in our deep dive into book 5.
I can't wait to see what else Aristotle has in store for us.
Me neither. It's always an adventure with Aristotle.
Okay, welcome back to our deep dive into Metaphysics book 5. My brain is still buzzing from all those amazing definitions we've just gone through.
I know what you mean. It's like Aristotle is giving us, I don't know, a secret decoder ring to understand reality itself.
I love that analogy. Like, we're learning the hidden language of existence.
Right. And the thing that's really striking me is it's not just about memorizing the definitions. It's about using them
as tools to think more clearly and more deeply about everything around us.
Exactly. It's like Aristotle saying, hey, if you want to understand the really big stuff, the meaning of life, existence, all that,
you got to start with the basics.
You got to get clear on the building blocks, the fundamental concepts.
And speaking of building blocks, I think it's time we add disposition to our Aristotelian toolkit.
Disposition. Oh, yeah. That one's all about, like, how things are organized, right?
Got it. The structure of things. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a building, a living organism, even a logical argument.
It's about how the parts fit together and how they relate to the whole.
Okay, so Imagine a house. The disposition of a house would be like
how all the rooms are arranged, the walls, the roof, everything fitting together to create a functional space.
Exactly. And it's not just physical objects either, right? We can also talk about the disposition of an argument.
Right. How all the different points and evidence are arranged. So it's persuasive, like it has a logical structure.
So disposition is about how things are put together in all aspects of reality.
From the physical world to the world of ideas, everything has a certain order, a certain arrangement.
It's like a reminder that things don't just exist randomly. There's a purpose behind their structure.
And their relationship to other things, too. Okay, so how about we tackle another one? It might seem simple, but trust me, it's got some hidden depths.
I'm intrigued. Which one are we looking at?
Having.
Having. Okay, so like owning stuff, right?
Well, it goes beyond simple possession. Aristotle's talking about like different kinds of having.
Oh, so it's not just about, you know, owning a car or a house or whatever.
Not exactly. It can also involve an activity. Like having can describe the relationship between, let's say, someone wearing clothes.
Okay, I see. Wearing clothes is a way of having them. It's not just owning them in your closet.
Right. And then it gets even more interesting because he talks about how you can't actually have the having itself. It's a bit mind-bending.
It's like he's pointing out the limits of language to describe certain ideas.
Yeah, always pushing us to think outside the box. But he also uses having in a couple of other senses, like a disposition that determines whether something is, you know, well-disposed or poorly disposed.
So, like, we could say someone has health, which is a good disposition.
Exactly, because their body's functioning well. But someone could also have a disease.
Which is a bad disposition.
Right, because it disrupts the body's proper functioning. And then there's a third way he uses having, where it's about possessing a part of a whole.
So like if you have a really strong heart, that's a having of the whole body.
Precisely. So having is this really multifaceted concept for Aristotle. It can refer to activity, to disposition, and even to the relationship between parts and wholes.
Okay, we've got to keep moving. So much ground to cover. What's next on our list?
How about we look at affection?
Affection. This one sounds a bit more emotional.
Well, yeah. In one sense, it does refer to emotions, but in a broader sense, affection for Aristotle is about the actualization of qualities that can be changed.
Okay. I'm not sure I follow. Can you give me an example?
Sure. So, like, a piece of fruit ripening, that's an affection, because the fruit's qualities are changing.
It's going from, like, green and unripe to red and juicy.
Exactly. Or how about experiencing joy or sadness? Those are affections, too.
Because our emotional state is changing. I get it. But you said affection could be used in a broader sense.
Right. It can also refer to changes that are, you know, harmful, like injuries.
So getting a cut or a bruise, that would be an affection too.
Yeah, because it's a change in the body. And we can even think about it on a larger scale, like going through a major misfortune.
That would be a kind of affection too, in a sense.
Yeah.
It's affecting our whole state of being.
Right. So affection can be both positive and negative. It just depends on the specific change that's happening.
Okay. Affection check. What's next?
How about privation?
Privation. That one seems pretty straightforward. It's just the absence of something. Right?
Yeah. But it's a little more nuanced than that. Aristotle talks about different kinds of privation.
Different kinds? What do you mean?
So first, there's the privation of something that, like, a thing wouldn't naturally have anyway.
Okay. So, like, we wouldn't say a rock is blind because rocks don't have eyes in the first place.
Exactly. That kind of absence doesn't really matter. But then there's the privation of something that a thing should have, you know, given its nature.
So a blind person is deprived of sight because humans are supposed to be able to see.
Right. And Aristotle takes it even further. He says that privation is only really privation if it happens when and where the attribute would normally be present.
Okay. So like, a baby isn't blind just because it can't see yet.
Exactly. It only becomes a privation if the baby doesn't develop sight later on when it normally would.
So privation isn't just about absence. It's about a lack that's significant to a thing's nature and development.
Deep.
It really makes you think about what it means for something to be, you know, lacking or deficient.
It's not just a neutral absence. It can actually impact a thing's ability to function properly. Okay, I'm ready for another one.
Right, how about to have or to hold?
To have or to hold. I feel like I'm at a wedding now.
Right. But Aristotle even finds a way to make this one philosophically interesting.
I'm all ears. Lay it on me.
So yeah, we usually use it in the context of possessions, like I have a book or I'm holding the keys.
The usual stuff.
But Aristotle sees holding as treating something in a certain way according to your nature. He gives the example of a tyrant holding a city.
So it's more about control and influence than actual physical possession.
You got it. And then having can also mean that something is present within, you know, a receptive thing.
Like the bronze has the form of the statue.
Right. Or a vessel holding liquid. And he also uses it to talk about things that, you know, prevent something else from moving freely.
Like a dam holding back water.
Yeah. So to have or to hold goes way beyond simple ownership.
It's all about relationships, how things interact and influence each other.
It's pretty amazing how much depth there is to even the simplest phrases, right?
Seriously. I'm starting to see the world in a whole new light.
That's the magic of Aristotle. He makes you realize that even the most ordinary concepts are actually full of meaning.
It's like he's giving us a whole new way to think and to understand reality itself.
And we're not even done yet. There's still so much more to explore in Book 5. So many more fascinating insights from Aristotle.
All right, welcome back to our deep dive. I'm still processing all those definitions from Book 5. It's like Aristotle was giving us a crash course in
the fundamental language of reality. I know, it's amazing.
It really is. It's like he's saying, okay, if you want to understand existence, change, purpose, all of that,
you got to start by understanding the basic concepts we use to even think about anything.
Right. It's like he's laying the foundation for all philosophy.
Exactly. And what's really striking me is just how careful he is with every single definition. It's like
he's not messing around. He's really trying to get this right.
Yeah. Each definition is so precise, so carefully crafted, like he's, I don't know, building a philosophical skyscraper. And every word is a brick.
Okay, I love that image. It's like he's creating this really strong, sturdy structure of thought.
And it's a structure that has stood the test of time, you know, influenced thinkers for centuries.
Okay, I've got to bring this up because it really blew my mind. Aristotle's view of good and evil.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one.
Because he's basically saying they're qualities, like, inherent in things. It's not about some external set of rules.
It's about how well something fulfills its purpose. Like, a good knife is a knife that cuts well.
And a good person
is someone who lives in accordance with their rational nature. It's all about living up to your potential.
But wait, doesn't that make morality, like, relative?
Oh, that's a great question. And yeah, it's something people have been debating for a long time. But I think what Aristotle would say is, even though the specific ways things are good might be different,
there's still some kind of universal principle of goodness.
Exactly. Like, health is good for all living things. But what makes a plant healthy is different from what makes a person healthy.
Folks, a good knife and a good person, they're good in different ways.
Yeah.
But there's still some underlying idea of goodness that applies to both.
Right. And I think this has big implications for how we think about, you know, ethics.
Yeah.
And how we live our lives.
It's like, before you judge something as good or bad, you have to ask, like, what's its purpose? What's it supposed to be doing?
And how well is it fulfilling that purpose? Really interesting way to think about things.
It really is. Okay. There's one more thing I have to ask about because it really threw me for a loop.
Mm.
Aristotle actually includes, like, negative concepts as a kind of reality.
Like falsehood.
Yeah, exactly. It seems counterintuitive, but
it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. He's not saying that falsehood is the same as truth or that it's a good thing.
Right, right.
But he's acknowledging that it exists. We have false beliefs. We say things that aren't true. And he's saying even that is a mode of being.
So he's basically expanding our idea of being to include not just what's true, but also what's false.
Exactly. It's about looking at reality in its entirety, the good, the bad, and everything in between.
No sugarcoating.
Nope. Aristotle's all about facing reality head on.
You know, it's really amazing to me how relevant his ideas still are today. We're talking about stuff he wrote centuries ago, and it still feels so fresh, so insightful.
I know. It's like his work speaks to something really deep within us, something that's timeless.
Our desire to understand the world, I guess, and ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. To figure out who we are, what we're doing here, what it all means.
And I think metaphysics, it gives us a framework to do that, or at least to start asking the right questions.
It definitely gives us the tools.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But wow, what an incredible journey through Book 5 of Metaphysics.
It's been a pleasure exploring these ideas with you.
Likewise. And for our listeners, if you're feeling adventurous, I highly recommend checking out Metaphysics yourself.
You might be surprised at what you discover about reality and about yourself, too.
And on that note, we'll wrap up this deep dive. Until next time, keep those philosophical minds engaged.